Tonight on This Is Vinyl Tap, don't play anything sentimental, it'll make me cry. Subliminal, Dummy Tech, or MTV. It filled me with religion, and it gave great comfort to me. And we're going to ride all night long, all along the ancient highway. Find a heavenly song, internal.
In 1948, Columbia Records introduced the 33 and a third RPM long player record. 1 year later, RCA Victor introduced the 45 RPM single. Listeners now had a choice, only the hits or the full album. In the last half of the 60s, the best bands realized the potential of the longer format and began to build a cohesive body of music that must be heard unbroken. The arrival of downloadable music has increased the temptation to stay in the shallow end with the hits. This podcast believes every album tells a story. Tonight, we tell one of those stories.
Well, good day, everybody. It is I, Tony Slagle, and I have the pleasure of being your host today. As always, I am joined by our normal host, Doug Cooper.
Just being normal.
And also joined by our very humble, the humblest producer you will ever meet, Jonathan J.M. Rowe.
Good evening, our afternoon tapsters.
So today we're going to discuss the 1986 album No Guru, No Method, No Teacher by Van Morrison.
Tony, I think there's something important to say.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, this may seem impossible, but our commitment to you, the listener, has increased another level. It has increased so much that we are now doing practice podcasts before we do the actual podcast. So not only are we putting the time into the research, into the listening, now we are doing time in the practice podcast. We don't always know we're practicing, but this one is a practiced podcast, and you're welcome.
any further explanation as to why?
You know, that's up to you guys. I sometimes more information is less.
Well, yeah. I was going to say, because we're talking about Van Morrison tonight, that we've been down this road before, but we've actually been down this road before.
Our second time.
Lots of connections.
This particular
not to give too much information, but we recorded a version of this that somehow disappeared into the ether. So
maybe we just wanted to do it at the new Vinegaroon instead of the old Vinegaroon to give it that new sound.
So anybody who listens to the podcasts in chronological order will then get a jarring thing when they listen to the next one because it's in the old one. So anyway, if you're following along with the story at home.
So. You know, small minds need chronological consistency. That's not us.
What, needing chronological consistency?
We're
or
beyond that.
Small
mind?
I got you.
We're beyond time.
Well, as I mentioned, we've been down this road before. Mainly what I wanted to address is that in May of 2021, during our very first season, episode 27, actually, of season one, if you want to go back and listen to it, we talked about Van Morrison's 1974 album, Veed and Fleece. And as a matter of fact, JM, you were in Colorado when we did that. Mm-hmm. When we recorded the first version of this, you were in Colorado,
as well.
You're not in Colorado now. We're all in the Vinegaroon.
The new Vinegaroon,
The new one. The
Wildwood.
Wildwood, is that what we're calling it now?
That's where we are. That's the U.S. Census Bureau designation for this area.
Okay.
And that's with a Y, ladies and gentlemen.
But I like it.
I like that.
I like it at Frog Pond.
That's the name of the farm.
Yeah.
Frog Pond Farm.
Yeah.
We inherited that name, ladies and gentlemen, which if you ever heard the Fornicating Frogs episode, that's highly appropriate.
Yeah. So the last time when we talked about Van Morrison, it was a Doug pick. Not surprisingly, this time it's a JM pick. You guys are Van Morrison aficionados, if you will. I am what you would call a Van Morrison novice. Would you not say that? Agree?
Of the three of us, you probably have the least exposure to Van Morrison.
I would
novice sounds more innocent than what you are. you're neglectful.
Well, he's one of those artists that I struggle with because I know I should know more about him. I don't ever think, oh, I'll put on a Van Morrison album. When I'm listening to Van Morrison, I don't think, oh, this is awful. I want it gone. I enjoy it. But I never think that I'm missing something by not listening to Van Morrison. I think you guys like wake up in the morning and try to figure out how can I put Van Morrison on, in my daily routine. But
I'm not as bad now. But there was a time when I would wake up in the morning and think, I need to listen to something else.
Well, so there you go. But anyway, just going back to whose pick this is JM's pick. And so we always go to the picker when we start off and ask, JM, why did you pick this particular Van Morrison album to revisit this artist?
Well, thanks, Tony. Plain and simple, I think of all of the Van Morrison albums that are out there, I think this is the one that I think is most accessible. When I talk to people and they say, hey, I've heard about this Van Morrison guy. What's a good album for me to start with? I usually suggest this one. And the reason why is I think it has a lot of what makes Van Morrison Van Morrison. The song structures are pretty loose. You know, he's got an ability, I think, to write songs that it's very easy for the musicians to fall into and kind of stretch out and play. So there's that. And I think his lyrics on this one kind of have that spirituality that he's known for, you know, that kind of mystical lyrics, I guess, is what he's known for. And I think the production on it is also very accessible. It's got a lot of neat strings and really cool horn arrangements. And so I think this is a really good introductory way to get to know Van Morrison. This is also kind of emblematic of what he was doing for most of, I would say, from the mid-70s or maybe the late 70s, from like Wavelength to even into the 90s. But there was a time during this where it seemed like every Van Morrison album had something similar, but there was something always different. Like the production would be different. There would be synthesizers being used. There would be, just straight acoustic instruments being used. This album kind of has all of that stuff. It's got the synthesizers. It's got the electric guitars, but it also has the acoustic guitars, acoustic upright bass and all that. So I think it's just a really good kind of where Van Morrison was during this period.
Okay. Well, thanks, Jam. I'm going to go to the other Van Morrison aficionado. And Doug, I'm going to ask you to weigh in on your thoughts on this particular album before we get started on a more in-depth conversation about the artist and what's happened since the last time we visited.
All right. And before I go on, I'm sorry if I seem a little out of sorts today, ladies and gentlemen. I had a dream last night, and it involved Joan Baez. And Joan Baez and I were both in the dream. We were both about 19 years old, and we were falling in love with each other at a youth camp. And it really seemed real. And Bob Dylan wasn't upset. And when I woke up, it wasn't true. So, I'm a happily married man, so that's confusing. But I was only 19, and that's over 30 years before I met my wife. So anyway, I have no reason to think Joan Baez feels the same way. What was odd is she had her complete catalog, and she was only 19.
Well, there that's is pretty that. Impressive. That is impressive. That's an impressive
very
feat.
Impressive, yeah. Yes.
Speaking of catalogs,
yes.
For Van Morrison, I love the six albums from Astral Weeks to Vin and Fleece. I think I've already expressed that. Kicking off from center field. Question on being down before the game. One shot deal don't matter. And the other one's the same.
Oh, my friend, I see you. Watch it to come through. Oh, yeah, they're standing in the shadows where the street lights all turn blue.
Those were my favorite.
Okay.
Then after that, there was a period of transition where Van Morrison didn't do very well until the comeback with Wavelength, which is great. And then there's another period, and I put this in it with along with Poetic Champions, Compose, and
Enlightenment.
Yeah. And what's the one that came out at the same time as Enlightenment? Or near the same time?
Hymns to the Silence.
Hymns of Silence is another good one. And then
Avalon Sunset.
Yeah. Avalon Sunset. Anyway. This would fall in the middle as far as how much I appreciate this album.
Okay.
Now, I did listen to this album when I was... This album came out and became... I owned it during the worst part of my life. And there probably is a connection with...
Your feelings about it and that? Yeah.
There's some fantastic material on this album. And there's some material that I just feel like asking Van Morrison to... take back and replace with something else. So it's a good album. I just don't put it at the top.
I think it's the most, for me, I think it's the most consistent of the albums during this period.
Van does have a lot of good albums for how do you say that?
The family set?
No, it's just making a family set. Maybe it's
for the activities that would happen in the 70s in a van.
Yeah,
is that what you're saying?
Some of it is very romantic, and at the same time, it doesn't. It's not.
Hey, baby, come here, romantic.
Right.
We're so spiritual, romantic.
So it's not. This van's don't come a knocking.
It's like Tristan and Isolde, romantic. You know.
Let's slide into some history between the two albums. Can one of you guys tell me what happened or what did happen with Van Morrison since we last visited him? I know there was a point where he stopped making music for about three years.
Yeah. So
do we know why?
I never really understood what the... I know
because Veed and Fleece happened, and then he kind of went away, right?
He got divorced. I know that was...
Yep.
And I think that weighed on him.
He had that extraordinary period of output. It always reminds me of the Moody Blues with that same extraordinary period of output for about six albums. And then
you're talking about, I think, just to clarify, you're not just talking quantity, you're talking quantity and quality.
Right.
Like they're put out a lot of albums, but there's very little.
I mean, I listened to almost every from Astral Weeks to Vinden Fleece. Those are always...
I could listen to them over and over again and never get tired.
Because there's a lot of people put out a lot of albums within a short period of time. But you're talking the quality fluctuated
for me,
very little.
It seems like he's not even in charge. It's just... it's compelled for him. It's just coming out of him. I compared him to Kris Kristofferson. Kris Kristofferson seems like such a tradesman at his work.
Right.
Van Morrison just looks like this antenna that's getting... filled up with Godzilla, where he starts getting all that radiation, or
and then before he spews out his atomic breath. Well,
that's how he seems.
I think he feels that way too.
I do too, and I think he's filled up with this muse, and he writes these songs, and he goes into the studio with the best musicians he can find, and he gives them the reins, and. He's often led by some of their ideas, I believe.
And
I think it works out very good. And if you'll notice, Todd Rundgren's never in the room. So this may be the opposite of Kris Kristofferson's songwriting and the opposite of Todd Rundgren's production.
Did he perform at all during those 3 years he was absent? When did Veed and Fleece come out?
1974 is when that was right after.
And when did the next album come out?
1977. That was
he did perform at least once.
I'm sure he performed
in November of 76.
That's right. He did. The famous band The Last Waltz.
And for anyone who's ever watched that, that's a guy having a brand. Oh.
So anyway, that's Van's remarkable performance on The Last Waltz, which in fact is a giant game of connections itself. Everybody in that show was there connected. Because they were connected to the band.
Yeah, and he's having the time of his life. While he's recording that, or performing that, obviously it's
and it's a little odd because I read a book about Van Morrison taping that or recording that for the film, and supposedly he was just petrified of going on stage. He even changed outfits, which I can't imagine Van Morrison being all that concerned about his outfit.
Man. Well, he should have changed a few more times.
Yeah, no, it's definitely sort of one of the highlights, if not the highlight of the performance. Okay, since we're talking connections, we're going to do the round robin thing, and I'm going to slide over to JM and ask you if you have any connections you want to talk about with Van Morrison, anything else. So again, I know it sounds like a broken record for those of you who've listened a long time, but any new listeners, what we do is we connect the album we're talking about currently or the artist we're talking about currently with podcasts that we've done in the past. So JM, do you have a connection with anything we've done in the past?
Yes, I have Kate St. John. She plays oboe and coringlay on this, which they're coringlay is basically a lower pitched oboe.
An oboe.
Yeah. And so she played on an album with Roger Eno. And Roger Eno is someone we mentioned in a recent podcast because he's got a brand new album out. And yes, Roger Eno is the brother of Brian Eno.
There you go. Yep. There's your bingo.
Got to have our bingo. But yeah, for those also, you might not think you know who Kate St. John is, but if you know the song Life in a Northern Town by
Dream Academy.
A Salvation Army band. Children drunk lemonade, and the morning lasted all day, and through an open window came.
I can't believe the Family Guy hasn't used that song in a.
Yeah, so that's that was
got lemonade. Is that what they said?
Yeah. Well, there's two other connections with podcasts with her. If you're using the Dream Academy analogy, because who produced that album, Jam?
David Gilmour.
And we talked about Pink Floyd and Wish You Were Here.
Yeah.
And I know I said I was going to do a round robin, but I'm gonna jump in since you brought her up and mentioned Lucinda Williams.
This one is blowing me away.
This is a stretch, but I'm going to say it anyway. So when we talked about Lucinda Williams, we talked about who she was married to, which was Greg Souders, and he was the drummer for the Long Riders. Kate St. John was married to Sid Griffin, who is one of the main songwriters and lead singer and guitarist for the Long Riders.
Wow.
So
my life's a circle.
Yeah.
So there you go. So we connect Kate St. John to Lucinda Williams through the Long Riders.
There you go.
That's great. Doug, you have a connection.
Well, I got really excited when you said you were going to skip me, and I was hoping you were going to keep doing that because I really don't have any connections. And I can't remember if I did during the practice episode.
I've got another.
Okay.
A very.
Just pretend JM's me.
Okay.
A very loose connection.
Doug JM.
Okay. The bass player on here is a guy named David Hayes.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in a band with Pete Sears.
Mm-hmm.
Who we talked about.
Jefferson.
Well, Pete Sears played with Jefferson Starship, but he also played on the Rod Stewart album we talked about. Every Picture Tells a Story. So he did the piano on that. Yeah.
Do you have any other connections? Because I have two more.
I don't think I have another connection.
I think we both feel a little disconnected this week.
Okay. Chrissy Hine.
I don't know that one.
She came in to do vocals on this album we're talking about tonight.
Is that right?
And was scared to death to be on a Van Morrison album. And he expected, this is not something that's going to surprise you guys as Van Morrison people. He expected her to know what to do without explaining anything.
Yeah.
And she did not get any help from him and essentially did not use Chrissy Hine.
Huh.
Chrissy Hine's vocals. So we talked about a Pretenders album previously. And Ry Cooder is also another connection.
Huh.
Ry Cooder was brought in to play guitar on this album.
Oh.
And Jeff Labes, who's
the pianist.
Pianist, he said that Morrison had seen him or knew that he had this album called Jazz. And I think Ry Cooder's on an album in the late 70s.
Yeah, but maybe
he's on Bright Side of the
Full Force Gale.
Yeah. Oh, it is Full Force Gale.
Whatever. Yeah. I think he forgot that he was on it because he asked him to come back because he'd seen this album. According to Jeff Labes, he'd seen this album called Jazz that Ry Cooder had done. And so Van Morrison hires him to come in and play guitar. He plays, plays on the first song. Van Morrison doesn't say a word.
Huh.
Plays another song, doesn't say a word. He does this throughout the whole album. And when he's done, Van Morrison looks at him and says, thanks, see ya. And then when Cooter's gone, Van Morrison leads over to Mick Glossop, who's also on the album, and says, I thought he played jazz. Of course, he said it in an Irish accent, not in a stupid Texas accent like I just did. And so he wasn't used on the album at all.
Huh.
So
that's hilarious.
That is.
And
I can't imagine Ry Cooder playing on this album either. But
I don't know where I'd put him in, but he could pull it off if he knew what he was being asked to do.
Well, obviously, again, Van Morrison's infamous for just kind of letting people riff, and if he likes it, if he doesn't, he doesn't. Right?
Yeah, he said in Astral Weeks he didn't even come out of the vocal booth.
Yeah,
and he's famous for just kind of you guys play, and
it works most of the time.
Most of the time, it works.
You did remind me of one connection.
Okay,
this is not very direct, but in reading about Ricky Lee Jones, she mentioned one time that she was at a party and one of her heroes walked in. Van Morrison,
mm-hmm.
and she ran out of the party
because
she was scared
to talk to him.
She didn't want to ruin her impression of him.
But she said that that's where she got her ideas for horn arrangements and stuff. She was, I read the same.
Well, he does seem like maybe one of those guys that if he's a hero of yours and you meet him, it might kind of change your perspective of things.
Yeah. You shouldn't meet your heroes, period.
I got one other connection. I just remembered.
Okay.
Ted Templeman. Ted Templeman, he was the producer for Ry Cooder, and he was producer for Randy Newman. He produced that album.
Okay.
And Ted Templeman produced a lot of the early Van Morrison albums. Not this one.
Okay.
But Ted Templeman also produced Van Halen.
That makes sense. You keep saying his name, and I'm thinking of the rat from what is it? Charlotte's Web.
If you isolate the vocals on a Van Morrison album and a Van Halen album, it's really hard to tell.
It is, absolutely. And the guitar work as well. I think it's really hard. Okay. Hey, they both have Van in their name.
Yeah, they both.
We've done two Van Morrisons.
Yeah.
And the chances of us ever doing Van Halen.
Well, I wouldn't hold your breath, Doug.
Two away from two.
Yeah, I wouldn't hold your breath. That may be coming down the pike at some point.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Well, we'll be stretching more, ladies and gentlemen. We've already done Black Sabbath. I stretched.
Yeah. So do we have more connections?
No, I don't think so.
I think we've gotten boring on that.
Well, there's one thing I want to say. The Ted Templeman thing. One of the things that happened during this period was Van Morrison was, I don't know if he was dropped from Warner Brothers, but for some reason he left Warner Brothers for Mercury. And I think this is the second album that he'd made for Mercury. The first one was
Sense of Wonder.
Yeah. Which is a fairly bizarre album. Even the album cover is bizarre, but
I like it quite a bit.
So, I don't know how much of the history of him we need to get into between these two albums, but I do have a question for you guys, and you can talk about it in terms of answering this question if you want to. You guys are in a much better position to answer this than I would be. We've talked about this artist before, and there's a big difference between the 29-year-old Van Morrison that recorded Veedon Fleece in 1974. And well, I'm asking this question, is there a big difference? And the one who was 41 years old, who was recording this album, we talked about Steve Fobert when he did his album and how his view of the world had sort of changed what he wrote about.
Right.
So you guys are very close to this artist. You followed his career a lot. Is there a perspective change in terms of what kind of what he's looking at, the lyrical themes, any of that stuff? Or is it,
I don't think that themes that much have changed. I mean, it's still mystical, but I think he's a little more literary because
he's read more books.
He's read more books, definitely.
And more things have made him upset.
Well,
I don't think he did I'm Mad About Something music in the early.
Well, he did. The St. Dominic's Preview is not exactly.
But don't come across as grumpy.
Yeah, that's true. But he is more grumpy on this. But you know, he's mentioned the literary thing. One of the things he was doing at this time, he was really into Blake, and so he kept trying to incorporate
Blake Shelton.
No, William Blake.
Oh, okay.
Just, he was is that the guy that has the singing show on TV.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, he's bad.
Yes.
So anyway, but there are a lot of poetry. He references poetry. He tried to actually set some of Blake's music to
William Blake
to poetry to music, and a lot of times he got shot down.
We'll talk about. There's one song in particular on this album that he reached out to the. To the estate,
yeah.
And there's a little compromise there. But anyway, well, so Jam, you mentioned mysticism.
Mm-hmm.
So before we get into talking about the album per se, I want to talk a little bit about what I think's the elephant in the room in terms of Van Morrison, and that's this the people who are into him talk about this mysticism or spirituality, surrounding his music. It seems to me, admittedly, as an outsider to a certain extent, that these themes, as you said, are kind of coursing through his work, but it also seems like he's always searching. Like there's not necessarily anything he lands on that he's able to grasp onto and move throughout that course of his musical discography. It's like it takes a little bit from here, a little bit from there. It's
right.
He seems restless. In
That's
terms
the word
of that.
I was going to use. He's restless as far as he had a hard time.
I thought Tony was talking about his spiritual.
Well, that's what I'm going to get to that. I think that what Van Morrison was trying, the theme in all of and these albums that are coming out are they do have a lot of the same sort of lyrical content, but the setting to them seems like it's very, very different. Like the albums before this one have those chorused guitars with high compression on them and everything, and then there's synthesizer. There's two albums that have a lot of synthesizer on them. And then this one is, like I was saying earlier, it's kind of a departure from what he had been doing. It's got the string sections and the kind of like he'd been doing on Veedon and Fleece. The strings are, kind of echoing the lyrics, and they're not just used as padding or anything like that. They're actually used to sort of show that restlessness. I think it sounds like a storm raging. In some cases.
Okay.
I thought you were saying something about spiritualism.
I was.
Oh, okay.
But I was.
I mean, that's what I take it. He's spiritually restless, and I think that's coming through.
He is. He's like a butterfly.
Well, so, yeah.
But I got a great answer for you.
Okay.
In case you want to answer to the question I asked. I don't know if we're doing that today. But jeez. When young people get spiritual, and I'm talking about college age, 20-something, when they get spiritual, they reject
tradition.
Their tradition.
Right.
And they go out and embrace all the other traditions. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I'm such a Buddhist now because they're so less, they're most spiritual. Sorry, ladies and gentlemen, they're coming for me, I think. Anyway, Van Morrison didn't do that. He didn't necessarily reject his own.
He was brought up. Is he Anglican or
he should have been? He is Jehovah's Witness. Oh, okay. On his mom's side. That's why he sings a Kingdom Hall song, which is fantastic. Yeah. he doesn't go Catholic or Irish in the whole Protestant deal. He does not reject his own tradition, but he does, at the same time, he embraces everything else. If you listen to those early albums, he's talking about Zen, and he's talking about everything under the sun. And then when he gets older, older people tend to return to their own tradition, see the wisdom in their own tradition, and start saying no to other traditions. He doesn't do either one. Van Morrison is very spiritual, and he doesn't ever say no to things. So he ends up with a highly contradictory set of, well, it's cognitive dissonance all over the place. All of these things, all of these traditions that contradict each other, but it doesn't matter to him. It's he just appreciates all of them, I guess. Nice way to say it.
I read a music critic that said that there's like this three-legged stool with Van Morrison's music. There's the spiritual belief. So it's this sort of trinity of women, or love, if you will, of God or spirituality, and then of ancestry or place. Like, those are the three
I think that's pretty accurate.
Three.
I would just add, I'm going to give the stool
another leg. Okay.
It needs something to do with American jazz and blues.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I think it's not just affecting his music. It affects the content of what he's talking
about. That makes sense.
Frequently.
Right. It's interesting that you talk about him, that he doesn't do, like, doesn't, as he gets older, doesn't necessarily embrace. He doesn't
forego it, but he embraces everything.
Yeah, because I think, what's the album before this one? Is it an Inarticulate Speech of the Heart? Is that two albums?
It's the,
that's much earlier, I believe.
Okay. Well,
Sense of Wonder is
in 83, which is when Inarticulate,
which is a fine
Speech
album.
Of the Heart.
I like it.
It's dedicated to L. Ron Hubbard.
Right.
Because he was embracing another sort of tenet of something as Scientology at that point.
Yeah.
When he was 70, I find this interesting. He said, I wouldn't touch religion with a 10-foot pole.
Right.
So it's not religion. It's not the dogmatic thing. It's this more kind of embracing these different spiritual aspects. And I guess whatever stage he's in at the time seemed to make sense to him. Does that sound right?
Of course, the statement about religion that he made is very dogmatic, which is, it reminds me of that bumper sticker I see all the time that says, "My karma ran over your dogma."
Oh, yeah.
Which karma, of course, is a dogma. So not quite as clever as they think they are, but that is I think Van Morrison would say that he rejects religion, even though he says, he's got a song about, she gives me religion. I don't think he's talking about organized religion. I think he's talking about something else.
Well, in terms of talking about the title of this album, which is No Guru, No Method, No Teacher, he said, this is a quote from him, "There have been many lies put out about me, and this finally states my position." He goes, "I'm not affiliated with any guru. I don't subscribe to any method. And for those people who don't know what a guru is, I don't have a teacher either." So again, that doesn't really explain much, but that's sort of his.
And he needs to go back and delete all his references to people who have led him to this point.
He is a very difficult guy to, if you read interviews with him, you see interviews, and he doesn't give many interviews. He's notorious for shunning the press, but he doesn't make any, I mean, stuff he talks about just doesn't make any sense. And he seems like a grumpy old man.
But I think his spirituality could be compared to the way he produces a record.
Yeah.
He hears it and says, "Oh, that's good. That's good. He hears this. It's good. It's
good." That's kind of what I was trying to get at earlier. Yeah, that's exactly what.
And then that works great in producing music, but for personal philosophy, you end up with all sorts of contradictory things.
Well, let's talk about where the album title actually comes from. So it's originated with this gentleman named, I believe this is how you pronounce it, Krishnamurti. Does that sound right?
Krishnamurti, Jadu Krishnamurti.
So the story that I understand about him is, this is a kid that was raised in semi-isolation by the Theosophical Society because they believed he was the coming world teacher prophesied by the society's founder. And but what happened was, once he became an adult, he absolutely rejected all of that and his role, And in rejecting it, he said, the moment you follow someone, you cease to follow the truth. There is no teacher, no pupil, there is no leader, there is no guru, there is no master, no savior. You yourself are the teacher and the pupil. You are the master, you are the guru, you are the leader, you are everything. And to understand is to transform what is. And Van Morrison said in an interview that he felt the meaning of Krishnamurti for our time is that one has to think for yourself and not be swayed by any outside religion or spiritual authorities, even though that saying that listening to this guy is to be swayed by one. But I think that quote...
That's very similar to what the Buddha said.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that quote, though, about you yourself, I think that it sort of is a thread that goes throughout most of the songs on this album.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
That's very true, and it's a self-contradictory statement, but that, as I've already mentioned, he doesn't mind.
It's a weird thing. I this is probably too harsh of a thing to say about it, but it seems like spiritual narcissism to me.
Well, there is a guru, there is a method, and there is a teacher. You're the guru.
Yeah.
It's your method.
Yeah.
And you're the teacher.
Right.
So it is. It's trust in the self, which, but I mean, we're not here to critique his spirituality.
No, but it's important to what we're talking about
it
tonight.
It does.
Yeah.
It illuminates the album.
Yeah.
And,
it's, I'm not putting judgment on it other than, I guess,
that's why I was talking to myself.
I think this is the album, and I'm trying to think of an album after this, but I don't know that he stays with this topic of spirituality as much in later albums. Like, it seems like there is spiritual. I mean, there's definitely in Avalon Sunset, there's all sorts of spirituality on there, but there's also, he's starting to get more into the ills of the world. And he's starting to revisit, you know, he starts talking more and more about guys that he grew up listening to, like Ray Charles. And
when at this point, he's recreating music that he grew up with.
You're right.
And seems to have very little interest in these items. Yeah.
So just briefly, in doing research about this, you read a lot. First of all, this album we're talking about is very highly regarded by a lot of people.
Yeah, you know who didn't regard it highly?
Rolling Stone magazine.
Well, does that surprise anybody who listens to this podcast? No. We routinely talk about how they changed. Did they change their mind about
it? I think they did. I think they raised it.
They rate albums the way I play darts. It's all over the place.
Yeah.
So, but in reading people who like this album, they connect it to two prior albums of his. One is the one we talked about, Veed and Fleece, and the other one is Astral Weeks. And I think Veed and Fleece, people connect that one to Astral Weeks as well. So there's like this line kind of, not through his discography, but almost like a jump from those three albums. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that that one thing that is, that those three albums have in common is the playing. I mean, I think that he found the players that could actually make these songs come alive. One thing before I forget, I want to say about Van Morrison. Listening to this album, I was trying to say, why do I think that Tom Petty and Van Morrison write similar songs? And I finally figured it out. Tom Petty writes simple songs with very simple chord progressions, but the chords come in unusual order. They don't go in the way that you expect them to go. He writes songs in strange ways. And this Van Morrison does that as well. And I think you can hear that a lot on this particular album, where the chord structures are, you know, the chords themselves aren't very fancy or anything, and they're not hard to play. The songs themselves aren't hard to play, but the chord progressions are surprising. And I think that that's why some of these musicians really like playing with him, is because I've heard people talk about how much fun it is to play Van Morrison songs, because they just kind of play, you know, write themselves. You can kind of find your groove in them pretty easily.
One of the other things that happens is when he was not performing or playing music, kind of left a void that other artists entered who were influenced by Van Morrison. And those
copycats
artists influenced by him seem to have struck not a pleasant chord with Mr. Morrison. He is upset that these artists are copying him, and that also is a theme on this album. We briefly mentioned the old man shaking his fist at the sky, and there's songs on this album where he's complaining about the people ripping him off, which I find interesting because the people he mentioned, Springsteen being one of them, I never made that connection. I say that because I was listening to this album this morning before I came over here, Doug, and my daughter goes, "So is that Bruce Springsteen or is that Little Steven? Who are you listening to?" And I said, "No, it's Van Morrison." And I just thought it was interesting that she picked up on that. Somebody who's not.
Do you remember when we did Wild and Innocent Knee Street Shuffle? Mm-hmm. When Springsteen heard Van Morrison, he lost complete interest in everything he was doing.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think it's pretty obvious on Wild Innocent and E Street Shuffle that he had some influence there.
Well,
but you can hear Van Morrison's influence all over the place.
The band, you can hear it in the Ricky Lee Jones.
It's everywhere. Bob Seger on.
That's another person he complains about is Bob Seger.
It's really evident. I'm trying to think of Against the Wind, where is one song on there that is. It's like he was asked to make the Van Morrison story soundtrack or something because it is so derivative. Well,
Why would he be upset about that?
You improved rock and roll, man.
Well,
you
not only that, but he left a void. I mean, it's weird to be angry at people coming to make music that sounded like you or were influenced by you when you weren't producing music yourself. Yeah. It's just an odd thing. So
it may be that he's talking about people who made a different kind, another level of money.
Well, I think that's probably it. I think there's a little bit of sour grapes about that.
I saw an interview with him after Avalon Sunset came out, and the report, I think it was on the Today Show or something, and the reporter asked him, like, why do you think that this particular album is getting striking such a chord with the record buying public? I mean, what's different about this album? He goes, I don't know. There's nothing different about this album compared to my other albums. I just think that the record company is pushing this one a little bit more.
And that's the one that had Have I Told You Lately?
Yeah.
Have I told you lately that I love you? Have I told you there's no one above? Fill my heart with gladness, take away my sadness.
Yeah, so he put a little love song on there that's irresistible and very accessible. And there's no surprise why that thing took off.
It's played at every wedding, white person wedding.
Okay, are you guys ready to talk a little bit about the album? I want to talk a little bit about JM, if you can, about where it was recorded and who's on it, if you don't mind.
Sure. So this is recorded at Record Plant in Sausalito, California. And that's kind of a famous recording studio. There's a lot of people that have used that recording studio, but the one that is really interesting, and it's one that he comes back to pretty frequently, is Townhouse Studios in London, which doesn't exist anymore. Unfortunately, it closed down, but he recorded a lot of the when he had used string sections, and I think he's recorded whole albums there before, but he's always seems to come back and do something during this period at Townhouse Studios.
Well, what I understand, the stuff in Sausalito was just five musicians.
Right.
It was Chris
Michie.
Michie, Jeff Labes, Baba Trundy, and David Hayes and Van Morrison.
Yeah.
And they just laid all the basic tracks down. And the studio you're talking about in London is where they sort of did some of the overdubbing.
That's where St. John came in and did all her, which is really surprising to me that those were, they wasn't all in the studio at the same time.
Well, and she, like anything, not to dredge up the same thing, but she goes in to try to do some stuff and there's no direction.
Right.
And he just said, go in and blow through it, is what he told her. And she did, and he liked it. So he's like, oh, that's great. Let's do the next song. And she, I think, was kind of surprised because she didn't know what she was doing that was so great. But he loved it. So
it's I don't know if he ever used her again after that. But it's just it really stands out on this album. I think it gives this album kind of a personality it wouldn't have otherwise, I think. But
speaking of personality, does anyone have information on who appears on the front cover with Van Morrison?
Do you? I thought it was just some sort of stone deity or something, like an old...
It looks like a dead person in a closet outside the house.
I think it's like a statue of...
It looks like one of those Chinese...
Like Confucius or something like that. I don't know.
It looks like their body was mummified.
Yeah.
Or saved in a bog.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I think it's a statue, but
I'm going to go ahead and say the record company did not pick the cover.
Well, is he known for having great art on the front of his covers?
I think you can be convinced that you will never need to worry about good art on a Van Morrison cover.
The Veed and Fleece album is pretty cool.
Fleece with the dogs.
Weird though.
Yeah. It is weird, but it's a cool album.
Somewhere with two giant Irish wolfhounds.
It's a little odd. I agree.
It's everything is odd. The best though is Sense of Wonder when he's dressed up like Zorro.
That's with the funny. Cape and the
back. I'm not familiar with that one. I'll have to look at
he's
that.
Got, yeah, so he's got funny. That hat.
Okay, one more thing I want to address before we go into it, and that's the production.
Yeah. It's very, very lush, I guess, is the production. It's very big, very echoey.
Very 80s.
You think it's very 80s?
Yes, I absolutely do.
I think that the albums before this were sounding a lot more 80s than this
it's,
one.
It sounds very mid 80s gloss to me.
Huh. Yeah.
It is a really clean.
It's very clean.
Bright album. I think it would be a good one if you have a new stereo and you're showing people.
I would agree with that. I think that it's got
very low lows and high highs.
Absolutely. There's a lot to pick up if you've got a decent stereo system to play through it. Is this 86 CDs were fairly, they were
fairly new, but yeah,
but they were still, I mean, it wasn't like they were a new thing.
No.
So yeah. That may explain some of the brightness because that was a thing that I think,
yeah, a lot of people were trying to let's see what we can do in the digital realm.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, guys. So why don't we dive into the album? That's what we're here for. That's what people hopefully are listening to us for. They don't necessarily care about any of that other stuff we talked about. So
I just one more very remarkable thing about this album. It is exactly an hour long.
Oh, really?
Is that right?
Like exactly 60 minutes. That's kind of interesting.
Very interesting.
And I'm sure he didn't plan that.
So again, that makes sense. CD era.
Yeah.
So that's the production and the length.
You know how they determined how long to make the CD?
Beethoven's Ninth.
That's right. They wanted to fit it on
one CD.
One CD. Yeah.
That's pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right.
That's a good. That's a good standard for everything, ladies and gentlemen.
All right. So let's go to the first song on side one. Got to Go Back.
I was a young boy back in Orange Field.
Yeah.
Used to look out my classroom window and dream.
Yeah.
And go home and listen to Ray say, I believed in my soul after school. I let love let what within me.
All right, that's a very Van Morrisey deal there.
Yeah,
we got Brother Ray mentioned, as he does in so many songs, and he's back in Orangefield. That comes up again and again.
He likes that Orangefield.
Orangefield, explain for the people not in the know.
He talks about Orangefield. I don't know what
it's about where he grew up.
Oh.
It's a boys' school that he went to, secondary school in East Belfast. I don't know if it's still around or not. But that's
this is what this guy that you mentioned talking about the stool kept talking about place.
Yeah.
And that is so true. All the time he's talking about place. Hanford Street where he grew up and Cypress Avenue where I guess that's where the rich people lived or whatever. He even did a concert on Hinesford Street.
Is that right?
Yeah. And all the locals were invited.
This is a very nostalgic song.
Very much.
I love the starkness of the song. I think the song's fantastic.
I do too. I think it's one of the best songs on the album. I love the Kate St. John.
And this is typical of his sort of stream of consciousness remembering stuff. Mm-hmm. Take me back.
No,
back.
That's on.
Be Thou My Vision.
Yeah. Just a Closer Walk with Thee.
Whatever it is. Anyway, we're off track, but it is typical of his songwriting. And I'm a sucker for somebody remembering childhood. That's one of my favorite themes.
Well, I wish my childhood was cool enough to have Ray Charles in it. Mine has Kenny Rogers in it.
Well, that's rough. That's John Denver. You've overcome a lot, don't you?
I had the Carpenters. But yeah, Hymns to the Silence. That's the album.
Hymns to the Silence.
Which is a fine album. Fine double album.
This also, he's you remember when he's talking about getting the radio and getting the Voice of America radio so he could hear all those jazz bands. And he just has a great love for that.
Yeah. One other thing, I want to comment on the drums on this. On this song. I think they're incredible. And he's playing them with brushes, you know, and so that gives it that kind of flapping sort of sound that's in the background. And I dig the drums on this.
I like the piano.
This is a jazz drummer.
Yeah. He and also the coringlay and that tenor soprano saxophone doing those two lines together. That's just amazing. Oh. I think that's actually an oboe in that soprano saxophone. I'm a sucker for a soprano saxophone and the oboe. So put those two together in a.
Or as Homer says, the obum oboe. Anyway, sorry. All right. Unless we want to keep talking about that great song, we move on to song number two. Oh, the Warm Feeling.
This is not about going to the bathroom.
Oh, the warm feeling. Have you sat beside the sea? Oh, the warm feeling. Yes, I've sat by you.
And it's another leg of the stool. Yeah. This is the lover this time.
Yeah. The playing on this is fantastic. I love those backup vocalists coming in. And that upright bass on this, played by David Hayes, is just remarkable.
I think this song really suffers from mid-80s production for me.
Really?
Oh, yeah. You know what this reminds me of? What? It reminds me of Avalon by Roxy Music, that same production sound. Huh. I don't know what's going on with the guitars, but there's this guitar slickness that happened in the 80s, and that's
okay,
on this song.
Okay, I'm going to give you that. Some of the guitars do sound...
talking about the acoustic guitars?
Yeah. They sound like they're being played through choruses, and it almost sounds like they're ovations.
Yeah, I bet they probably are.
Yeah, it could be, yeah.
Well, I want to go on record as hating Ovations. And during the time they were popular, when everybody was showing up.
Everybody was playing.
And then after the Ovations came the Takamine era. I hate both of those guitars. And
I like the Takaminis.
Not me. But I have bad memories of packing up Takaminis on the road when I was working for a certain somebody. But I do like the acoustic guitars. I don't like... I agree about this. It's got that... it's a shallow sound that I think Ovation was responsible for.
And the weird vibe, are those keys making that vibey sound, or
it's a actual vibraphone.
Okay. And you know, not to disagree too much with you, JM, but I'm not a fan of the background singing on this. No.
I think it works.
If to me, if you were going to take, a mid-80s production list and say it needs and have a list, a checkbox of various things, this might check 90% of it. I mean, I feel I'm going to say there's an album, and I don't know why I feel this way about this song, and I don't necessarily, maybe because it's an artist I like, even though I rarely go back to this album, but it reminds me as well of Radio Chaos by Roger Waters. Uh-huh. Has that same production sound, the same background singing, all of that stuff. It all just sounds like check.
Well, these backup vocalists, I think, are on a lot of albums from the 80s. Is it Bianca Thornton? I think she was on all sorts of albums from that time. But this was the song that I heard. By the time this album came out, I was a really big Van Morrison fan. I mean, I think I had almost every album up until this album, by the time this album came out. And I remember I was driving home from camp. and I turned on the radio and I heard this song and I didn't know who it was. And then I go, man, this sounds a lot like Van Morrison. And sure enough, it was. But
I wonder if I had not heard this when it came out, if some of the production things Tony's talking about would stand out more than they do to me, because I've been listening to it since it was the 80s.
Yeah.
So it's harder to tell that.
And maybe that explains why I can listen to Radio Chaos and not feel that way about it.
And even it might be why I can listen to Roxy Avalon. Yeah.
Because it's something I bought that album when it came out in 87.
That's so interesting, because there are Brothers in Arms came out at this time, and which I think is a fantastic album, but it does have that kind of 80s production on it as well.
I don't know. I struggled not to skip this song.
Huh.
But
I like it.
I do.
I wouldn't mind a different production on it, but it doesn't bother me. You know, the production on Enlightenment, I like quite a bit, and might like all of this album better if it had the same
kind of,
it's
doesn't have the same sheen. There's a sheen to this one.
It's a flat finish.
And we're talking about how, I mean, this, everybody listening to us probably understands this. This is all, a lot of our opinions are just that, right?
Yeah.
And who knows what colors them?
We're talking about taste, not quality.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. All right. Moving on to song number three, Foreign Window.
I saw you from a foreign window, bearing down the suffering road. You were carrying your burden. To the palace of the Lord, to the palace of the Lord.
It's funny you mentioned it. I'm hearing that guitar. There's two guitars in this, one from the 70s and one from the 80s.
What I can't explain about this is this has a lot of the same elements from the last song, but I like this song. I think it's his vocal performance on this song.
I think it's vocal performance, and I think it's also the chord progression. It's that chord progression where he's starting off in that minor, and he's talking about the, you know, suffering down the road. And
his vocals on this song are just outstanding.
Yeah.
But that's something we didn't mention when we talked about the different bands. He had to change the way he sang from the way he started by the time he got to this.
He can't
album.
Do that.
Was he lower his register?
Much lower. Yeah.
Much fuller.
But I think the difference between Foreign Window and Oh, the Warm Feeling is, even though Oh, the Warm Feeling is a love song, this seems like there's a lot more emotion in what he's, the way he sings. I don't know. Maybe that's just my perception.
You're right. I think the lyrics are, you know, just much more compelling.
Yeah.
I'm sitting by you and I got a warm feeling, but this is more like I'm looking at you. You know,
well, this is another one where he starts spilling everything he's been carrying.
Yeah.
Every book he's been reading.
What does he say? I saw you from a foreign window bearing down the suffering road. What is the foreign window? Like, I don't understand why.
Well, all you got to do is figure out what he is reading. I'm not sure what it is either, but
yeah.
Maybe it has something. I'm going to pontificate here. Maybe it has something to do with just looking at somebody through unfamiliar circumstances or surroundings or something, you know, a foreign window. This is not the way I normally envision you or normally see you.
But he sees her like, I see you with your burden now.
Yeah. And yeah. I mean, maybe that's what that means. Uh-huh. I have no idea, but it's just a thought.
No, that's good. I like that.
We'll stick with it. All right. Here comes a fun one to talk about. A Town Called Paradise.
Cowboy cats ripped off my socks. Cowboy cats ripped off my words. Cowboy cats ripped off my melody. Doesn't matter what they say. It doesn't matter what they do. All that matters is relationship to you.
This is a weird song.
It is a weird song.
Lyrically, that is.
It's irresistible. if this song were in a language you didn't know, it would be absolutely irresistible.
Yeah.
And I want to say for the audience, it's only the first verse where he starts nagging about
shaking his fist at this guy.
Yeah. You know what's odd is that
it's a beautiful love song if you could just skip the first verse.
Right. It has nothing to do with the rest of the song.
No, it's just like
he's just like, you're at woe is me. And
I'll tell you where it comes from. So he evidently played a concert. He played live prior to this album coming out, and he played three songs from this album. One of them was this song. And he says, evidently, he's referring himself in the third person. He says, if Van Morrison was a gunslinger, there'd be a terrible lot of dead copycats. There are absolutely no copycats in paradise, just my little corner I've carved out for myself. So maybe the connection with the rest of the song. I don't know.
When he's singing that, I always chuckle to myself when he's saying copycats ripped off my words. And does the bass line to you sound the same as I venture into slips?
If I ventured in the slipstream between the viaducts of your dream.
Well, let's also talk about it. Isn't
Astral Weeks what I was talking about? Yeah.
Okay.
Is that what you think?
No, I was just saying that this later on in this song, he essentially rips off Lou Reed's Walk on the Wild Side.
Oh, yeah, he does. I was thinking that today.
So he's complaining about copycats, and then he essentially, I don't know if that was intentional or not, but it sure sounds like it.
Yeah, I thought the same thing listening to it today. Going, man, that sure sounds like Walk on the Wild Side.
It sure does. Yeah. I mean, including the bass, not that, but even the bass line in it does.
Yeah.
But as Doug said, if you can get past the old man shaking his fist in the first three lines, this is a fantastic song.
Yeah. And it's very dynamic. Is another thing I love when it drops down and those horns just do that.
And nobody handles a break better.
Yeah.
With just,
Well, that's another thing that Van Morrison has the ability to do is that if you look at a lot of songwriters, I mean, there's the lyrical structure is the same, you know, throughout the song. Van Morrison rarely,
he
doesn't see a need to do that. Yeah.
We could say that he's relieved himself of any consistency in any area of his life.
Yeah. And it's very apparent on,
but it makes it work. And that's why he works with jazz musicians. I'm sure that's what he needs.
And that's what he gets from James Brown, Wilson Pickett, all those guys,
all his heroes.
And here he is talking about copycats and
he's emulating.
Yeah.
I do think Doug hit the nail on the head. It's not so much that he's upset about people taking his style and doing something with it. It's that they have been able to be significantly more successful doing it than he has.
Yeah. And I would just, the only caveat I'd add to that is financially successful.
That's what I mean.
I think he's had as successful a career as anybody.
I don't know if there's a better regarded.
Yeah. And he's had some dips, but not big dips. Just 5-year dips at the most.
Yeah. He's been lionized probably more than just about any.
He sure is trying to
living artist. Yeah,
put a knife in that legacy lately, though.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Anyway,
it's a highlight of the album, I think. Yeah,
He says this too. He says, "I was influenced by Ray Charles and other people I was starting out, but there came a point when I found my own voice, and I found myself influencing lots of people after I had originated something. For years, people have been saying to me, you know, nudge, nudge, have you heard this guy Springsteen? You should really check him out. I just ignored it. Then 4 or 5 months ago, I was in Amsterdam and a friend of mine put on a video. Springsteen came on. He's definitely ripped me off. I mean, he's even ripped off my movements and I'm pissed off about it now." This is what he said in 1985.
Bruce Springsteen having the same movements as Van Morrison is hilarious.
That
you don't see Van Morrison jumping up on pianos. And
well, and that cracks me up because if you're James Brown, I think you can talk about movements.
Yeah.
If you're Van Morrison, I've only seen one video where he moves.
Yeah. I've seen him in concert.
We gotta go.
I've seen him in concert 4 times and every time he's just like sits there in front of the microphone, or he'll have a saxophone, and he doesn't, he hardly moves, hardly talks to the audience at all.
Yeah.
And
the complete opposite of Springsteen.
It's complete opposite.
It couldn't be for, if, I mean, that's funny. Yeah. Well, that's really funny.
Anyway, yeah. Not to dwell too much on it. I just find it's, I find this kind of compelling that he's,
yeah,
that he's got this.
I understand him accusing people of ripping off his music and style.
Yeah.
But it, when he says, he might as well accuse Springsteen of copying his wardrobe. I mean, it's just silly.
Yeah.
All right. So,
Liberace stole my wardrobe.
We've got the next song, which is the last song, I believe, on side one, yep. In the Garden.
After a summer shower, when I saw you standing in the garden, wet with rain.
That guitar strumming was very reminiscent of Astro Weeks.
Yeah, also. Yeah. His singing on this song is just remarkable. I'm just always blown away by the way he sings. And it goes to that thing I was just talking about. He rushes lyrics, and then he'll give them space, and then he'll say the next lyric. And then, you know, it just, they come in at times where you don't expect it. It's like they say Van Morrison uses his voice like an instrument. Well, that's when they say that, that's what they mean. He doesn't come in. He's not just sitting up there reciting lyrics. You know,
it's like a jazz singer does.
Mm-hmm. It's like, it's not like Bob Dylan or anybody does. He you know,
it's like Satchmo.
Yeah. Yeah.
His voice is free to come in and go out whenever it wants, just mm-hmm. like his trumpet is.
Yeah.
And that's how Van does too. Yeah.
So this is where we get the album title from this song, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this wet with rain thing, which is something he talks about, I guess that's in what, Sweet Thing?
Sweet Thing.
He loves gardens and he loves wet gardens. Yeah. And it'd be interesting to find out how many times he finds himself with a girl in a wet garden.
Yes.
So, Doug, I want to touch again on something that you had mentioned about this stuff, just kind of him being a vessel. He said what inspired the song was he was sitting in his flat apartment to us over here on the other side of the pond one day, and a voice came to him and told him to write this down. So he pulled out a paper, he just wrote down what he was told, and this was the song.
Well, I believe it.
Yeah. So there's one thing I wanted. There is something on this album, and I know that a lot of times that the producer will, to get they don't want to use a metronome. They want to get the timing of the song, but they don't want to use a metronome because it will just be too static. So they'll have the drummer sit in front of a microphone with two drumsticks and bang them together mm-hmm. like that. I swear that they left that in on this song.
Yeah.
Because it sounds like, because there's this part where it, when it starts off, there's just something that sounds like, I can't figure it. It's not a drum, and it's some sort of tick, tick, tick sound. And I can't figure out what it was. And I just, you know, it was the other day, I was just thinking, I wonder if they just left the click track in. I mean, that's hence the name. That's where when they say click track.
It's that.
That's what the click track
is. You know, the funny thing is when we were initially doing research for our practice version of this podcast, I was searching for the song, and it said, and there was an article about Van Morrison, and it said the song had been covered by Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash, and Willie Nelson. I was like, wait a minute. Elvis has been dead for years. Well, there's a hymn by the same name, and whoever wrote the article got a little confused.
God, that's funny. Hilarious. I like that. I like that. This would be a very difficult song to imitate.
I wouldn't even attempt to try
it. Yeah, it would be bizarre.
Yeah.
All right. So we're ready to flip the album over?
I think so.
So song, flip the album over. The song, first song on side two is Turn a Nog.
Nog.
He was turning in the kingdom. And by the mansion gate, we stood enraptured by the silence. As the birds sang the heavenly song, in turn and over. He stopped in the Church of Ireland.
It is Turn and Ogre.
Is it Tiernan Og?
Yeah, that's what he just said.
I thought he said Tiernan. I always heard it as Tiernan Og when he sings it, but I guess I'm not that good at hearing.
So this is named after a mythical Celtic land of eternal youth.
Right. And there's that part that says the only way to get there is to never come back. And I wouldn't want that, would you? I always thought that was just an amazing. After I knew what this was about, I always thought that was a great line.
I could listen to this song all day long.
This is
good because it's almost 8 minutes long.
Yeah. This is one of the best songs he's ever written, I think.
It feels spiritual to me in a way that none of the other songs on this album do.
Well, and it's that call and response of the strings to his voice, what he's talking about. Outside the storm was raging, and the strings just do that amazing thing. And then the way that the strings come in and out, and they'll keep the cello going through parts of it. It's just remarkable.
I mean, his voice is incredible. It's a very uplifting sounding song. So,
and then the way the instruments are being used in unusual ways, like when they the strings do that, I guess what you call it, a glissando up the scale, the violin neck, and you know, not actually hitting and staying on any one note. I've read people, you know, artists that I like, when they talk about Van Morrison, this song comes up quite frequently. This is one of Sinead O'Connor's favorite songs, by the way. She mentioned it almost every interview I read.
And William Butler Yeats,
he makes his opinion,
wrote a poem about events that this is a very romantic, it's all that wonderful,
it's that Tristan and Isolde thing that I was talking about,
all the old wonderful tales that can't be true but should be.
Yeah.
And this song interrupts the album in my mind, and with a heavier, bigger thing than the other ones. It's more gravitas. It seems like it's saying to the other songs, "That was fine, thank you. Now is the event."
Yeah,
and I think it's well placed, because if it came after the other songs on this album,
it shouldn't be an album opener, and
it should be the closer, but it can't be the closer because the stuff that comes after it doesn't fit the rest of the record very well.
Yeah,
I think it comes One Irish Rover would be fine, but we're leaving the Emerald Islands, and we're going to go into some cities that are dirty.
Yeah. We're going through the mist out into the real world. Yeah.
We're going through the wardrobe.
But this is one of my favorite Van Morrison songs. This is one of my favorite songs, period. And I remember the first time I heard it just being devastated.
I think it's the best on the album.
Yep.
Yeah. Agreed. All right. We ready to move on?
Yeah. Yep. This is a redo of a hit he had.
Well, it's a play on words, right?
Yes. It is.
Yeah. Here comes the night.
On the road with my sword. This love will surely last forever.
he sure hits on something with these lyrics, where he is still kind of keeping us in that.
No, we haven't left the Emerald Island. I was premature on that.
Yeah.
Well,
it's, I think, another remarkable song. But now that you keep hearing those 80s guitars, now that you're
talking
about it. Yeah.
Well, this, okay, as Doug mentioned before we started the song, this is a play on an old Them song called Here Comes the Night. But that night was spelled like the darkness of the night. This is spelled like the chivalrous.
Yeah.
And he's coming to get his gal.
And again, we're talking about his voice. You know, he turns like three words into nine. You know, I'm on the road with my sword and my shield.
Well, and Doug, you mentioned Yeats in the last song. So this actually has some of the lyrics are based on it, on the epitaph of his of W.B. Yeats' gravestone. It was one of Van Morrison's favorite poets.
This is a pretty funny story.
Yeah, he went to the estate to ask if he could put a poem to music, and they said no. So instead, he said, "Well, I'll just use this gravestone because that's public domain. Right. Nobody can complain about that." So he took "Here Comes a Horseman Through the Pass. They say cast a cold eye on life, on death." So that was on Yeats's gravestone.
And I think they relented and let him
put a poem to music.
Yeah, they actually recorded a version of it. And it didn't make it onto they couldn't put it on the album.
Right.
And so it's really underproduced if you hear it, but it's on that Philosopher's Stone album that came out, I guess, early 2000s. It's the outtakes of different stuff, but it's actually on there.
Speaking of outtakes, just real quick, is he able to produce things the same way twice?
I don't think so.
I don't think he can perform things the same way twice.
Well, that's what I'm asking. He seems like one of those people that if you're going to see him live,
yeah,
I've seen it ain't him live, sounded like the album.
I've seen him live four times. I don't think I've ever seen him do the same song twice. One time I saw him back to back days. I don't think he did the same song except not the same set. The only song that he did was the song "Philosopher's Stone." Twice, but he did "Summertime in England" one time when I saw him, and it was done completely different than the version that's on "Common One." It was much faster. But
did he do "Brown Eyed Girl"?
This one time I saw him, he did "Brown Eyed Girl." He was playing with Glenda Gale Lewis, Jerry Lee Lewis's sister.
Yeah, his sister.
And so they were doing they did a medley of like old time hits, and they did some Chuck Berry, and the guitar player did the duck walk and all that sort of stuff.
I would love to be there when these girls that love that song go to see Van Morrison because he sings that.
All right. So, moving on to the next song. It's another Fish Shaker. Thanks for the information.
This is the number one Fish Shaker, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thanks for the information. Never give a sucker an even break. Every time he's breaking through to a new level of consciousness, there always seems to be more obstacles in the way.
So what's this song about?
It's about everything that makes him mad over the several months before they recorded this. And every cliche he's happened to hear in his whole life.
Yeah. What is that Sublimity, Domin, Tech, and MTV line? I still don't understand what that line is.
I don't know. What is it?
Sublimity? I don't know. I can't even find it.
Talking about subliminal messages coming from his television and MTV.
It says the word MTV, which kind of takes you. It's so different from everything else.
It's just a list of things that make him mad. And then he gets a bunch of cliches. It's one in the hand is worth two in the bush. And I mean, it's just, and they seem random. It's like he had a cliche generator.
Yeah. It is Tony, you were saying mid-80s. This, to me, is the most mid-80s.
It sounds like a new wave song.
It does. The
guitar. I see people in skinny ties. I mean, I almost hear driver's seat or something like that.
Yeah. But Jenny, this is was a, sweet. This is the longest song on the album. And
it'd be such a good one to have forgotten to put on.
Except it's got that wonderful chorus.
That's a good chorus.
And I wish he would have taken that and put it in another song.
It's just and.
But he's being sarcastic. It's wonderful. Yeah. It's marvelous. How did we ever see it through?
We just went from a sweet song about saving a little princess.
We went from the Celtic wonderland in the mist. And now
can I say something? Elvis Costello can do sarcasm. Van Morrison. No, not really his strong suit.
He just needs to be a drunken rant.
If you're doing sarcasm, you got to be the happy warrior. You got to be grinning, and
he's not.
He's mad.
He's bellicose. He is.
He wants to.
Yeah, he wants to beat the hell out of it. Yeah. He wants to pound his fist, and he wants to spill your beer and slap you in the face. It's just...
Yeah, we should move on. Ladies and gentlemen, this is why God created the fast forward.
If they would have left this off, it would have been almost a flawless album. Yep. Anyway.
All right.
And moving it was on. Plenty long enough to leave it off.
60 minutes. Moving on to the next song, One Irish Rover.
I know the exact setting on the keyboard that they're using on. This is a Yamaha DX7, and this is the electric piano setting on the Yamaha.
I don't like the way the song starts off. The song starts off is so corny to me.
Why not use a piano? Would have been fine to have used just a regular piano on this.
Have y'all ever heard those stories about people who die and they're allowed to come back?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
That happened to me, and it involves this song. It involves me. I did experience death for 26 minutes. I was declared dead, and during that time, the only thing I remember is they were playing this song, except it was the Chieftains backing up Van Morrison instead of that stupid piano.
And I've seen him do this song with Bob Dylan.
Well, no, before. I was going to say one thing that the song, one good thing, there's other things, but the one really kind of good thing that this song gives us is there's a movie called One Irish Rover.
It's a documentary.
About Van Morrison. And there's a scene in it with him and Dylan sitting on the Hill of Muses outside above Athens, Greece, playing this song. And it's really great.
Yeah. And then there's... if you can find it, it's a really good...
I think it's on YouTube.
Is it?
I think so.
Yeah, it's got a rare video of Van playing drums with the Chieftains. But yeah, this is a really beautiful song, but you're talking about that 80s production. Now I'm hearing it all over the place.
How did you listen to this and not hear it?
Well, that synthesizer sound at the beginning of it, of this particular song, actually. Yeah,
the reason I was laughing when we stopped playing the song was Jam was just looking at me with a smile on his face the whole time. I kind of feel bad now that I've
pulled the veil back, if you will. It's a wonderful song if it just didn't have, the playing on it is excellent, even except for that. The bass playing is phenomenal on it, and the drums are just beautiful. Well,
one of the musicians, and I can't remember which one that's on this album, said when he came to the recording sessions with this song, the original lyric was "one Roman soldier."
Really?
And he changed it for some reason to "one Irish Rover."
Is that Roman, like...
Yeah, like the Rome, not like walking around. And I think the musician, if I wish I could remember who it was saying that he thought there was some sort of connotation with the crucifixion or something.
Really?
But but he doesn't know why he changed it, so he's not sure if that's true or not. And maybe it's just one of those things like scrambled eggs with yesterday. It was just something that he put in that he wanted to, he liked the cadence of or something.
Yeah. But
then he remembered he was from Ireland.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. All right.
Okay.
Okay. Moving on to the
last song.
Last song on the old album, Ivory Tower.
When you come down from your ivory tower, you will see how it really must be. When you come down, down from your ivory tower, you will see how it really must be to be like me.
This song stands out like a sore thumb on this album.
I agree with you.
I love this song, but like it's like, too, where did this come from?
I agree. It doesn't sound like it was made in the same studio with the same musician. It just sounds...
This is R&B Van, not Irish Van.
Right.
This song actually was a minor hit. It peaked at number 21 on the U.S. mainstream
rock. My album here, it's got a little sticker telling you to buy it because that song's on there.
Yeah, it hit number 21 in the mainstream rock charts.
You're taking away from the rest of the album. It's a good song.
It doesn't really fit in terms of musically or...
It fits a little bit because he's complaining again.
Yeah, no, that's true.
That's the only way. It's a fine song, and... I wish he were. I don't know who is in the ivory tower that he's upset about.
I'm sure it's record.
I'm positive execs. It's not the same people I think of.
Yeah, it's probably record execs and who else? I don't know. The haves.
The haves, yes. The one percenters. Yeah, I mean, it's just, this isn't what I listened to Van Morrison for, to be honest with you. I love the way that the piano starts out on it, but it's too tinkly. It needs to be more guttural, that lower register kind of gospel-y sounded piano. But
it'd be better if it were done in the fashion that Real Gone.
Oh,
these guys know so much about Van Morrison that most of the time they're wrong about their memories of it because it's just all a big blur.
If they had done Real, Real Gone with that,
that
would have been fantastic for this album.
Yeah.
But he couldn't have done it because that sound is so different.
Yeah. Thanks for the information and this song. Do take me out of the realm of the rest of the album. And it seems like everything else is like the spiritual journey, going to mythic lands, going to, the land of eternal youth and all that. These two songs, thanks for the information, and One Irish and Ivory Tower, just take me out of that. And I wish there were a way that he could have come up with a better ending.
Well, I think both of those songs musically sound unlike anything else on the album. That's for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that wraps up the album, boys. Jam, is there anything you want to talk about post this album or anything else about Mr. Van Morrison that the listeners might be interested in?
I'm sure we'll do another Van Morrison album before this podcast is done.
Before this podcast program is done. Yes. Not this particular podcast.
I hope we don't do that.
So he kind of has kept producing just, in my opinion, phenomenal albums for like the next almost 10 years. And he made an album soon after this with the Chieftains, where he did kind of explore his Irish roots, and that's a fine, fine album.
One of the best.
What's it called?
Irish Heartbeat. And he does
a lot of covers and a few of his own with the Chieftains.
Well, when it's covers of
put the Chieftains on
it's
anything.
Folk songs. It's Irish folk songs. I mean, he does Kerry Fargus. He does Star of the County Down. It's just, there's some beautiful songs on there, and he does it with the Chieftains, which is a stroke of genius.
It's a little bit obvious. I don't know that you have to be a genius.
Yeah.
Well, it's like the Pogues playing with the Dubliners.
Right.
It's like, okay. It sort of makes sense, guys. Yeah. Why? What took so long?
Yeah. But, anyway, it's a, that's a fantastic album. And then I guess he became.
Well, you've skipped Poetic Champions Composed.
Poetic Champions Composed is, this could almost be, this album and Poetic Champions Composed, they could almost be a double album.
That they're, yeah, I do think the production is different on some of the things that Tony was objecting to aren't on Poetic Champions Composed. Right,
but they still got the lush strings, and you got the harp that comes in. There's just some absolutely beautiful songs on that next album. Alan Watts Blues is a really cool song.
What's he up to now? Well, didn't he release a pretty... Like, I think, Doug, didn't you listen to his most recent album? It was pretty good.
Well, it was the most recent.
Okay.
Then, but it's not anymore.
But which album was that?
What was that? This Bird Can Sing?
Yeah, that is a great album.
That's not what it's called. That's a Beatles song, but it has a bird on the cover.
I think it is. Your Birds Can Sing. Yeah, but it's a really good album.
You got a Shuffle album came out not long ago. That was fun.
Yeah. He started...
I mean, Skiffle.
Oh, Skiffle album. Skiffle. But he kind of got to... And he started making albums that were... Where he wasn't doing a lot of the writing. He was doing the Skiffle sessions where he was doing old Skiffle songs. He did a country album.
Pay the Devil.
Yeah, Pay the Devil, which he does a pretty good... You know, he does some Hank Williams songs.
And, oh, really?
Yeah.
There Stands the Glass.
Which, really? Yeah, how is that?
It's very good.
I'm going to have to dial that up.
It's got Cindy Cash Dollar on it playing Metal Steel. So it's okay. So he started later in life, he started kind of revisiting the music that, you know, he listened to in his youth. He made an album with Mose Allison. He did a cover album of like old soul standards and with Georgie Fame, so the Blue Flames, and then most recently
Accentuate the Positive.
Yeah, that's a great album. That's a really good. It's got Pee Wee Ellis on it playing. You know, Pee Wee Ellis was the
R&B country songs,
but more and more songs started having more of that, you know, curmudgeonly old man, hey, everybody's ripping me off kind of stuff, that they became more prominent, I guess, on some of his albums. But most recently, I mean, and then it's kind of culminated in this latest thing that he's done that is just all about, you know, being locked up during COVID-19 and almost conspiracy theory type stuff that he's it's very odd, the movement that,
well, him and my favorite guitarist kind of got together and shook their fists at the sky about COVID, right?
Yeah, you and Eric Clapton.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
you know, my favorite guitarist, Eric Clapton.
Yeah,
I saw an interview of Van Morrison, and he pointed out that he was really upset that he couldn't play, but this politician was allowed to have, he said the rule was no singing. And he said, as soon as they made that rule, my gig was canceled. And then I find out this politician has a meeting at the same place with somebody singing.
Yeah.
So that may have been what pushed his button. I don't know.
But, well, it's almost like 24 songs or something, just railing on it, which is...
Yeah, which is an abuse of your popularity.
Right. Well, I agree. It's just like you don't need...
I love that phrase. We need to use that a lot on this podcast, an abuse of your popularity. That's awesome. There's a lot of artists that do that.
Yeah.
Things like government policy on COVID.
Yeah.
That is something that someone could take exception to.
Yeah.
But I think the essay is the format for that and not music. I think it's very difficult to write a anti-COVID policy song.
Well, that's why any political song is really difficult to...
I think you can do anti-war pretty well if you're not putting too fine a point on it. You could be anti-ignoring the poor pretty well.
Yeah.
But those are broad topics. There's general agreement about it's bad. There may not be agreement about what's the right thing to do. But when you get into COVID policy, I think...
Well, there's the album that came out before that not accentuate the pod, the latest record project, Volume 1, that has got just, I think it's got some pre-COVID songs on there that are just ridiculous. And
ridiculous in what way?
Just, it's the exact opposite of everything that we were talking about, his mysticism. It's the, there's no mythology in it. It's everything is just about the world today. And it's just not what you listen to Van Morrison for. You don't really, I don't really care. In general, I don't care what any entertainer has to say about the state of the world.
That's
Well, don't go to a Roger Waters concert.
No way.
There's a lot of concerts. I can't go see Springsteen anymore because I'll get a lecture. And then after he's through lecturing everybody and telling us all how bad the current leader is, when his guy gets elected, he goes, "Let's all come together now," in a Jeep commercial. That was the funniest thing I ever saw. I have a friend who, if I call him up, he'll start telling me everything wrong with the world. And it's almost like he thinks I don't have access to news and that I live in this place where they don't have cable or internet. So that's what I think about when these musicians get up there and start telling us what they saw on the news and how bad it is. We don't need you for that.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Write an essay.
A persuasive essay.
I mean, it depends. I mean, there's some musicians who their whole sort of MO is writing about
stuff. Well, it's like Billy Bragg and all that. It's like, I can't stand
that. But if you like that stuff, then it makes sense. Right. But if it sort of comes in ebbs and flows, you're not really sure. Like, oh, I don't listen to this artist because of that. I know that that's part of who they are. You know, it can rub you the wrong way, regardless of what your politics are, or what their politics are.
I don't want to hear someone get up and agree with me and sing songs about cutting capital gains taxes.
Yeah.
It's just,
I mean, yeah, I don't, if you mention something politically and you know that the crowd's going to cheer at it, I mean, what's the point? Why do you do this?
Why are we doing it?
Right. Anyway, all right. Yeah. So this is the point in the podcast, guys, when we go to the ratings. We give two ratings. One is a rating for our critical rating, you know, just absent of any sort of emotional attachment to the album. Did this artist do, you know, in terms of either comparison to the other work or other artists, where is this on the critical scale? And then our personal rating, which essentially boils down to, will we listen to this album again? So I'm going to start with Doug, since he did not pick this album. Doug, what say you?
Okay, so I think for the longest part of my life, Van Morrison has been my favorite. And I'm always in the mood to hear Van Morrison. I'm not that frequently in the mood to hear this album. Of the Van Morrison albums that I have and know well, this is towards the bottom of that list in terms of things that I like. However, I think it is definitely an album worth having. I'm going to give my personal rating is going to be a 4.4, and critical rating would be 4.5.
Okay. Thank you, Doug. I'm going to go next since this was a jam pick. I'm not going to be a dead horse here in terms of my familiarity with the artist. I will say that I don't remember what I rated this when we did the practice podcast, but my personal rating is going to be a 3.5. And the reason why I say that is because after we did the podcast, I didn't necessarily find myself going, oh, I'd like to put on that Van Morrison album. So I think I don't want to give it too low a rating because it doesn't deserve a low rating in terms of, because there's songs on it. I like it when I listen to it. It's just not something that jumps at me that says, hey. And I think critically, I'm going to give it a 4.0. You know what? I'm going to give it a 3.8. The production just rubs me the wrong way. Again, we talked about that. It's a personal taste. And I know that's not my personal rating, but you can't help have that kind of sort of come into the critical stuff in terms of when this album was released. That mid 80s production just knocks it down a bit. And the lyrical themes of, you know, the old grumpy guy on at least three of the songs sort of bumps it down. So 3.5 personal, 3.8 critical. Jam.
All right. Thanks, Tony. I'm going to start off with my personal feeling rating first. I'm going to give it a 4.5. This is one of my favorite Van Morrison albums, but I don't even know if I would put it in the top five of one of my favorite Van Morrison albums. But I think it is as I was saying at the start of this, a very good introduction to Van Morrison and what he is capable of doing in his strengths. I think my, you know, my favorite is definitely Astral Weeks, and I think that a close or a second is going to be Into the Music, but then it gets kind of muddled. But I think that it's just, it takes me to different places when I listen to this album, and I, you know, listening to it for the practice podcast and for this podcast, I was kind of transported into an imaginary world. And he can do that, I think, better than just about any songwriter, on the planet. My critics rating, I'm going to give it a 4.2. And the reason why I'm giving it a 4.2 is I think you got to knock him a little bit for those, for Thanks for the Information and Ivory Tower. Yeah, like you were saying, Tony, it's like a sore thumb on this album. Ivory Tower is, but I do think it's Van Morrison lyrically hitting on, you know, all cylinders. And I think that the musicianship on this is just phenomenal. And it's really hard to get past that. I almost think that the rest of the, you know, there's 10 songs on the album. I think the other 8 just really lift the other 2 out of the muck. So I think it's an album very much worth having.
All right. Thank you, guys. All right. So normally this is Tony. I give the recommendations. I don't know why I said this is Tony, but it is.
They're great.
But I'm going to pass the recommendation mantle over to Jonathan J.M. Rowe.
Thank
and
you.
Allow him to regale us with what he thinks would be a good fit.
Well, I'm just, we've talked about it throughout the podcast, and we should have mentioned, I'm sure we mentioned this when we talked about the band, but the Last Waltz by the band is a phenomenal movie, and it's one of the, consistently comes up as one of the best rock concert movies ever done.
And there ain't no big suits in it.
No big suits, no dancing with lamps. But you just have the band at their peak, they left at their peak, and it's directed by Martin Scorsese. There are some, wrote stories about being in the band, and there's some cutaway footage and stuff like that. But most of it is just the band on stage with musicians that they absolutely love. It's got Eric Clapton. It's got Ringo Starr. It's got Dr. John. It is
Neil Young.
Who is that, Doug? Who's on
Neil
it?
Neil Young.
Joni Mitchell. Alan Toussaint does the horn arrangements. It is just a phenomenal album or phenomenal movie, rock movie. And the soundtrack is also really, really good. It's a 3-album soundtrack, but it's very
rockumentary.
I wouldn't call it a rockumentary. I call it a concert movie. Okay. But it's a phenomenal concert movie.
A concert that's filmed as a movie.
Right.
Does that help?
Yeah, that was helpful.
Thank you, Tony, for hosting this week. And thank you, dear listener, for letting us fill your airwaves again with another episode of This Is Vinyl Tap, the podcast that always goes to 11. If you know anyone who likes the long player format, please let them know about this podcast. We're available on most podcasting platforms. And if you could go up there and leave us a review, leave us some stars, we'd really appreciate it. We're always looking for feedback. Also, you can reach us via Twitter at Tapping Vinyl. Or you can visit our Facebook group page, which is getting a lot of activity these days. And also, if you're old school like we are, you can email us at tappingvinyl@gmail.com. But for the ultimate This Is Vinyl Tap experience, please visit our website. Up there, you'll find links to our past episodes. You'll find additional information about the artists that we've talked about and the albums that we've talked about. All sorts of good stuff up there. You can also leave us a review there as well. Next week, we'll be looking at an album by one of the proto power pop bands, the Flaming Groovies, and their album, Shake Some Action. Host Doug Cooper, our co-host Tony Slagle, and me, your humble producer, Jonathan J. M. Rowe. This is Vinyl Tap, where all the podcasts go to 11, and we're hoping you get that squealing feeling. Next week, we're going to be looking at an album by one of the more obscure power pop bands from the mid-70s, who started in the 60s, the Flaming Groovies, and their album, Piece of Your Action.
Shake Some Action.
Shake Some Action. Jeez.
Are you gonna pull Shake Some Action up?
Piece of Your Action. What the hell is that coming? Is it?
I have no idea.
That's a Motley Crue.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, maybe you're wishing we did Motley Crue instead of.
No, I guarantee.
This is no guru, no method, no teacher. This is our second try. It is December 9th. Action.
Tonight on This Is Vinyl Tap. Guys, maybe the universe is trying to tell us something.
There's something that God doesn't like about this album. Trying to think of what heresy he says.
We got a B that's not a B.
It's
to,
a C.
To be or not to be.